Stories of Journey to the West, Chapter 10.
Okay, let's dive in. Picture this, it's chaos. The Tang Dynasty capital, right? Bustling city, and then suddenly a dragon's head just falls out of the sky.
Right in front of Emperor Taizong.
Exactly, in front of the emperor, the whole court. They're just standing there completely stunned. I mean, what an image to start with.
It really is. And that incredible scene, it kicks off this whole amazing story, mundane at first.
Right. Emperor Taizong, it's around midday. He's playing Go.
With his advisor, Wei Xiang. A strategy game.
Totally focused. And then Wei Xiang just falls asleep.
Mid-game. Just nods off right there.
Seems small, but that's the spark, isn't it?
It really is. Mm-hmm. Because what happens next is, well, it's a complete shift. No more quiet game.
No. Suddenly, Generals Qin Shi Bao and Yu Qi Jingde burst in.
And they're carrying, well, the dragon head we mentioned.
Oh, man. Severed, bloody. Imagine the scene in the court.
Utter disbelief. Floored. I mean, weird weather, sure. A dragon head.
From the sky. Yeah, that's not normal. And everyone looks at Wei Xiang. And Wei Xiang's explanation is, well, it's something else.
It really is legendary stuff. He just calmly says, oh, I beheaded it in my dream.
Just like that.
Yep. Says he was, like, whisked away on a cloud while he was asleep.
To an execution platform.
Apparently. Finds the dragon there, tied up. He declares he has this divine order to execute it. The dragon pleads.
But Wei Xiang just chops its head off. In the dream.
Swiftly, according to the text. And what's really fascinating is how quickly everyone seems to, well, sort of accept this. Yeah. Initially, anyway.
Yeah, the emperor even praises him. Calls it, like, loyalty, power.
But, and this is a huge but.
Right, there's a catch. The text suggests the emperor already had a dream.
A dream where he promised to save that exact dragon.
So, boom. Instant conflict. He just praised the guy who killed the dragon he promised to protect. Makes you wonder about promises made in dreams.
Exactly. The weight they carried. So despite the praise and ordering the head displayed, rewarding Wei Xiang, the emperor's clearly uneasy.
And that night, things get worse.
Much worse. The Jing River Dragon King shows up. In his dream, obviously.
Oh, seeking revenge.
You got it. Accuses Taizong of betrayal, breaking his oath. It gets physical, apparently.
Whoa. Like the ghost dragon attacks him in the dream.
Tries to drag him off to the underworld for judgment, yeah. Mm. The source says the emperor is just, you know, terrified, powerless, wakes up in a cold sweat.
Man, even an emperor isn't safe from ghosts, it seems.
Especially not when oaths are broken. But then, just as it looks really bad.
Help arrives.
Divine help. Guanyin Bodhisattva appears.
Wow, okay.
It's clouds, very auspicious. And she just flicks a willow branch.
And that works.
Apparently. The headless dragon spirit just wails and retreats. The text mentions she was just passing through Chang'e and heard the commotion.
Talk about being in the right place at the right time. So a bit of Buddhist influence there.
Definitely. But the emperor, he wakes up completely panicked, raving about ghosts.
The palace must have been in chaos.
Total chaos. They call the imperial doctor.
And the diagnosis.
It's grim. His pulse is all over the place. He's delirious, seeing things.
And they think it's because of the ghost.
They link it directly.
Yeah.
And they give him, what, 7 days?
7 days to live. Wow. That escalated quickly. It really shows how they connected physical illness with, well, supernatural trouble.
Precisely. His decline is tied right to that dragon encounter. And this sets up the next, even more unbelievable part of the story.
Okay, so the emperor's dying. Time's running out. What's the next move?
He calls for his best generals, right? Qin Shi Bao and Yu Qi Jingde.
Yep, the big guns. To guard the palace gates.
And they're not just standing there in normal uniforms, are they? No way. The text describes them in full gleaming armor, holding these incredible golden weapons, like symbols of earthly power standing against the invisible.
A supernatural security force.
Pretty much. And it works.
Yeah.
For a few nights, anyway. No more ghosts at the main gates.
Shows they believed you could fight spirits with, well, strong enough guardians.
But of course, the trouble just moves.
Right. The disturbances shift to the rear palace gate.
So who does the emperor put there?
Wei Xiang, the guy who started it all, in a way.
Armed with the very sword he supposedly used in the dream.
Oh, the irony. The dream dragon slayer now guarding a real gate.
Yeah, and he looks the part, too, apparently. Very formidable. Like fighting fire with fire or supernatural with supernatural.
Even with these guys, the emperor's fading fast.
Yeah, it's not enough. He's getting weaker.
Mm.
So weak, the court starts talking arrangements.
Funeral plans. Seems like it's over.
But then Wei Xiang steps in again, with a really out there idea.
What does he suggest?
He suggests writing a letter to the underworld.
You're kidding.
Nope. Specifically to a guy named Kuiju.
Who's Kuiju?
He was a high-ranking official under Taizong's father, important guy, but also Wei Zhang's sworn brother. And crucially, he's now believed to be a judge down there.
In the underworld, like processing souls.
Exactly. Overseeing the books of life and death. The idea is that maybe this connection, this brotherhood, can help.
So the plan is the dying emperor takes the letter with him.
That's the plan. A desperate gamble that Kuiju will feel obligated, you know, because of their bond, to send the emperor's soul back.
That's audacious. Does the emperor agree?
He does. He's out of options. And then he passes away.
So his soul leaves his body, and his first thought.
He thinks he's going hunting.
Seriously? Even as a soul?
Yeah, clinging to earthly things, I guess. But then he realizes he's alone, lost, until Kuiju shows up.
The underworld judge himself comes to meet him.
Summons him, actually. Shows the kind of power Kuiju supposedly has now.
And then what's he like?
Official robes, carrying a tablet, and importantly, he has the book. The Register of Life and Death.
Wow.
He greets the emperor, apologizes for being a bit late, and explains why he's there.
Which is?
The Jing River Dragon. He's filed charges in the underworld against the emperor.
Ah, so the dragon did press his case.
Yep. Kuiju confirms Taizong needs to answer for it. He clarifies his own past service and his current job, judge of life and death, in Fengdu, the underworld capital.
Okay, so this is happening. What about the letter?
The emperor hands it over.
And Kuiju's reaction?
He's thrilled. Says he already knew about Wei Jing killing the dragon in the dream, and he owes Wei Jing big time for past kindnesses to his family.
So the connection worked.
Seems like it. He immediately promises the emperor he'll make sure he gets back to the living world. It really highlights that sense of obligation, loyalty, even after death.
Amazing. So what happens next? Does he just send him back?
Not quite yet. First, the emperor has to go deeper. Messengers arrive from the king of hell.
The big boss downstairs.
Well, 10 big bosses, the 10 kings of hell, they escort the emperor further in.
Where do they go first?
Through the Ghost Gate Pass.
Yeah.
Sounds charming.
Not really.
And then he runs into some familiar faces. His dead father. His brothers.
The ones he had issues with.
Those very ones. They are not happy to see him. They want payback.
Yikes.
Yeah. But Kuiju steps in, uses a scary ghost messenger to drive them off, keeps the emperor safe.
Good old Kuiju. Where do they go then?
To the main event. The Hall of the Underworld. Very grand, apparently. And the 10 kings themselves come out to greet Emperor Taizong.
Do they treat him like a prisoner?
No, actually, with respect, like visiting royalty.
Yeah.
Hierarchy still matters, even down there.
So the trial, they ask about the dragon, right?
They do. Emperor Taizong tells the story again. Wei Zhang, the dream, the divine mandate, more like fate, using Wei Zhang as the instrument. He argues it was predetermined.
And the kings buy it.
They do. They reveal it was already written, basically.
Mm.
In the stars, the Southern Dipper constellation, which apparently controls lifespans, the dragon's time was up, and it was fated to be killed by a human official.
So the dragon's protest was just procedure?
Pretty much. Case closed on that front. Then they turned to the emperor's own lifespan.
Ah, the main issue. What do the records say?
Kuiju checks the big book, and it confirms. Taizong was meant to die right then. 13th year of the Zhengguan era.
So that's it?
Not quite. This is where Kuiju pulls his move. He takes out a brush
and
changes the record. The character for a 1 and 13, he adds 2 strokes, makes it 3.
So 13 becomes 33.
Effectively, yeah.
Yeah.
Giving 20 extra years of life, just like that.
He just rewrote fate.
Bold move, right. Shows that maybe fate isn't totally fixed, especially if you know the right people downstairs.
And the head honcho, the king of hell, is okay with this.
Confirms it. Tells the emperor he gets 20 more years and can go back.
Incredible. Before he leaves, does he ask about anything else?
He does. Asks about his family back home. Tells the emperor they're mostly okay, though maybe his sister won't live quite as long.
Okay. And does the emperor offer anything in return for, you know, life?
He does. He asks what gift he can send back to the underworld.
And what do the kings of hell want? Gold. Jewels.
Pumpkins.
Pumpkins. Seriously.
Nangua, specifically. They say they've got plenty of other melons, but they're short on pumpkins down there.
That's weirdly specific and mundane.
Makes the underworld seem a little more, I don't know, relatable. Anyway, the emperor promises to send loads when he gets back.
Okay, so deal done. Time to go home. How does he get back?
Kuiju and a bailiff guide him out. But the route back is different.
More dangerous.
That's what the emperor thinks. Kuiju explains the paths aren't the same. And they're going via the Bakien Mountain. Basically, a tour of the grim side.
Oh, great. What's that like?
Pretty much what you'd expect. Dark clouds, black fog, ghosts, demons lurking everywhere. Definitely not scenic.
Sounds like a nightmare landscape.
Total contrast to the organized court they just left. And from there, Kuiju gives them the full tour. The 18 levels of hell.
Whoa.
18.
18 distinct levels. And they have these incredibly evocative names. Things like Hanging Sinews Hell, Utter Wrongdoing Hell, Fire Pit Hell, Oil Cauldron Hell, the one you mentioned. It's like a whole taxonomy of suffering.
It really is. A whole catalog.
Yeah.
And it goes on. You've got Darkness Hell, Knife Mountain Hell, even Ice Hell. Brr.
And then the really physically invasive ones, like Flaying Hell.
Disembowelment Hell.
Blood Pool Hell. And then there's Avicii Hell, which sounds particularly final.
And still more. Scale Hell, Grinding Hell, Mortar Hell, Wheel Crushing Hell. There's even one called Ooh Hell and Tongue Pulling Skinning.
The variety itself says something, doesn't it? About what kinds of actions were singled out.
Yeah, let's get into that. Who ends up where and why? There's one about cheating the foolish and simple with large and small measures.
Right. And the consequence is described as leading to disaster accumulating upon oneself. It suggests a real focus on fair dealing, especially protecting vulnerable people.
Makes sense. Exploitation was clearly a big concern.
Seems like it. Maybe tied to social stability. You know, trust.
Okay, what about this one? Concealing one's conscience, acting unfairly, using clever words to harm others in secret. That sounds like hypocrisy, hidden attacks.
Exactly. Malice disguised and the punishment. Skin peeled off, bones exposed, arms broken, sinews severed. It's incredibly brutal.
Visceral, yeah. Maybe a fear of deception undermining everything.
I think so. In a society maybe reliant on direct relationships, that kind of hidden rot would be terrifying.
Then there's the disloyalty and impiety that violate heavenly principles. The phrase, a mouth of Buddha but a heart of a snake, really stands out.
Mm-hmm. That brings in the spiritual angle. Faking piety while being corrupt inside gets you tightly bound and shackled.
So sincerity and belief was key. It makes you wonder what those heavenly principles were precisely in this context.
That's a great question. It points to the underlying value system.
And then we see the bullies, strong and violent people who bully the good and kind, but are described as hiding their heads and shrinking back miserably in hell.
Yeah, there's a kind of reversal there. They get beaten until they're frowning with bitterness, faces bloody, and nobody helps them.
Poetic justice, almost. Mm. A clear condemnation of aggression against the meek.
Definitely a value placed on protecting the vulnerable.
What about greed? And violence, plotting for wealth, harming lives, slaughtering animals.
Oh, that description is quite something. Faces covered in filth, hair disheveled, skin split open, teeth bared, and sounds of weeping, misery, loneliness.
Wow. It really paints a picture of utter degradation resulting from greed and, well, violence against life itself, maybe reflecting worries in an agrarian society.
Could be. Dependence on community, on the natural order.
Something that really hits home reading these is the sense of finality. No way out.
Absolutely. Phrases like suffer for 1,000 years with no release.
Or sink forever with no turning back. It's absolute. No parole board in this system.
No chance for redemption seems to be offered here, at least not in these passages. It's incredibly stark.
And just make sure you get the picture. There are enforcers.
Right. The ox-headed ghosts and horse-faced ghosts with iron maces and copper hammers.
And red-haired ghosts and black-faced ghosts with long spears and short swords. These aren't just concepts. They're populated by terrifying figures.
It really drives home the inescapable nature of it all. These figures ensure the punishments are carried out.
So the core message seems pretty clear, doesn't it?
I'd say so. Good and evil at the end have their recompense, only the arrival is sooner or later.
And that direct warning, in life, do not deceive your heart. For the gods and ghosts are clear-sighted and will let no one off. A real insight into their moral code.
Definitely sends a message. What comes after hell?
Bridges. Over a river of blood, no less.
Lovely.
There's a golden bridge for the good souls. Mm. Easy crossing.
And for everyone else.
The Nahi Bridge, which sounds terrifying. Rickety, dangerous, souls falling off, demons grabbing at them. It's all about judgment, the different paths awaiting people.
Okay, hell, scary bridges. Where next?
The City of the Unjustly Dead.
Uh-oh. This sounds like trouble again.
Big trouble. This is where all the ghosts who died unfairly or too soon hang out, including rebels and princes Taizong himself might have dealt with.
And they recognize him.
Immediately. And they want their lives back. They crowd around him, demanding justice.
That's intense. The idea that unresolved stuff, injustice, follows you even after death.
Powerfully shown here. These spirits feel cheated, and the emperor is, understandably, scared stiff.
What can he do? Does Kuiju help again?
He does. Kuiju explains, these ghosts are stuck because they're basically broke. No resources to move on in the afterlife system.
So they need money, ghost money.
Sort of. Kuiju suggests the emperor borrow treasure, silver, and gold from a living person who apparently has, like, an account in the underworld, a rich guy named Shang Liang.
Wait, living people have bank accounts in hell?
It's a fascinating idea, right? This exchange between worlds, the emperor promises to pay Shang Liang back with interest once he's alive again.
And this treasure buys off the ghosts.
That's the plan. They secure a loan from Shang Liang's underworld stash, distribute it, and the angry ghosts are pacified. They let the emperor pass.
Wow. A financial transaction saves him from vengeful spirits.
It reflects this idea of interconnectedness, that earthly structures and needs have parallels below. But there's one more promise.
What's that?
The emperor vows that when he gets back, he'll hold a huge religious ceremony, a water and land ceremony, to help these unjustly dead souls finally find peace and transcend. It's like an imperial obligation to the restless dead.
Okay, so promises made, debts arranged. He can finally leave.
He finally escapes the city of the unjustly dead. His soul is guided away, heading back towards the land of the living.
What an absolutely incredible journey. Through the courts of hell, past vengeful spirits, altering fate itself.
It really makes you think, doesn't it? The thin line between life and death, the power of promises, and the reach of bureaucracy, even into the afterlife.
Definitely. And maybe it leaves us wondering, what unseen forces, what kind of connections or consequences might be shaping our own lives just beneath the surface?